Woo!
Welcome to the Somewhere Called Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
Happy Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
And I got some big starfish vibes going on over here on this Tuesday.
Starfish vibes? What does that mean?
Well, we went to the aquarium yesterday with Leo. It was so much fun. I love doing random stuff with Leo, and the aquarium happened to be it. But I learned at the aquarium that starfish can eject their stomach out of their mouth and then just like whoop and swallow food and then stick it back inside.
Yeah, the way starfish consume food is very interesting. So they just sit there and then gently pull on like bivalves, like clams. And then when the shells open up, their stomach envelops them, which is exactly what I do with Fritos bags. So I felt very much in line with starfish too. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. We actually didn't talk about this at the aquarium. I'm really glad that you feel the same way. Well, actually like 99% of the time I want to like intricately feel the food go down my mouth. You know, I really enjoy eating food. But every once in a while on a rest day or at the end of an ultra, I just want to go and just like flop a whole pizza or a Subway sandwich or something and just have it go down straight into my stomach.
Yeah, I agree too. Should I make a dirty joke here or dirty reference perhaps? Maybe I shouldn't.
And we definitely should.
We should?
I mean, we're at least 45 seconds.
Yeah,
you already said the word bivalve. At this point, we've been scientific enough. We've earned a sexy joke.
For every bivalve, I get one sex joke. But, you know, like, dirty talk would be like, I want you inside of me or something. That's how I am with Fritos. Is that okay?
No. That's totally okay.
It's not even a joke.
No, that's great.
Okay, it's totally fine. But yeah, the aquarium was very fun. One of the more harrowing parts of the aquarium journey, though, was we walked through. This is the Denver Downtown Aquarium. And as you get out of the exhibit, you go down the stairs, and the very first thing awaiting you is a seafood restaurant. Literally a restaurant run by the aquarium that advertises their seafood after you exit. One of the weirdest things I've ever seen.
How does no one talk about that? There was nothing in the reviews about that. All the reviews were like, yo, the mermaids were so hot.
Yeah.
They never talked about the fact that we were like, you could eat exotic fish after you spent 2 hours looking at them and marveling at them.
Yeah, it is really interesting that that was like a dinner foreplay situation.
It's so strange. The restaurant was pretty empty though.
Yeah, well, I mean, that makes me feel good. There was also a bar that was out there, and there were a few people just drinking alone at the aquarium bar, which was a vibe. I really wanted to go sit down and find out their stories.
Yeah, it was interesting. They weren't alone, though, because next to the bar, there was like a whole other tank with fish.
Oh, you're true.
So they were just being joined by the fish, which I get it. Like, I'm an extreme introvert. I would love to just like drink a beer with fish.
Just drinking with the stingrays.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds like a vibe.
Doesn't that sound great?
It does sound pretty great.
Honestly, I'd rather drink with a lot of stingrays than people, to be honest with you. Yeah. I have like a note card of people that I would rather drink with compared to stingrays.
Yeah, that's so true. I felt a little weird at the aquarium because overall, fish kind of freak me out slightly.
Which is strange. You studied fish.
Yeah.
You were like one of the experts on lionfish and like some of the ethics related to lionfish fishing and all kinds of
ocean
things.
Ocean and coastal law.
Yeah.
I had done a lot of cool things in that world, but at the same time, fish, I don't really feel fish. We're not really on the same page.
See, I love the fish. Leo has been really into fish between Moana and his books. And so I have been trying to learn all about fish, which actually didn't pan out really well because I was walking around, everything was, Leo, look at that big fish. I knew no names of fish. I had zero education on fish and the ocean. But I feel the same way too. Like, I feel so much more comfortable in like
terrestrial environment.
A woodland area or a mountain area, and like put me in the ocean or any sort of like lagoon like area and I would run. Yeah.
It was really sweet actually though, because a lot of the times in the aquarium there were smaller tanks, and in those small tanks there were always like two fish together. And sometimes there was a throuple of different fish. At one point there was like an eel, a shark, and they were all getting freaky. It was very interesting, but it was kind of sweet to see these fish just partnering up, often kind of spooning in the tank.
They were bivalving.
There was a lot of Frito scissoring going on there. Yeah, and I don't know, that made me reflect a little bit on life and getting to spend life with you.
Yeah, I felt the same way. There was these two purple fish that were just like, they were at the bottom of the tank, just kind of hanging and chilling with each other. And it felt like the best post-ultra vibes. It's like, all I want to do the rest of our lives is just like hang out, watch Tour de France and chill like these fish. They seemed so content.
That was relationship goals. I was thinking those fish, like Harrison Ford and Chewbacca, and then maybe the couple at the end of the Titanic. Like that couple, I also vibe with that relationship.
Well, they're hanging with the fish right now.
That's true. Yeah. Oh my God, you buttoned that up so well. And we have the best episode for you, as you can probably tell with these energies. We're going to start with some like high country tips that are just kind of interesting things that you can learn from things that we've gone through. A new 8K record? That'll be a little bit of a spicy thing. the best restaurant in the world, which is not the seafood restaurant in the aquarium.
Actually, you could DoorDash from the seafood restaurant in the aquarium. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's actually probably the better option because you don't actually have to walk past all the fish that you're about to consume.
But maybe the people that eat at the aquarium restaurant really do want to consume the fish after looking at them. Could you imagine if you went to a zoo and then all of a sudden it was like, and here is tiger tartare. That would be really cool. Okay, then talking about AI and athletics, something that we feel is going to be really interesting in the future. Stress mechanisms and what that means for training on a new study. A Tour de France wrap-up. People have loved those conversations. A discussion on hormones. Quote, loving running from a listener question. Possibly a discussion of liquid fueling and then finishing it up with hot takes.
I'm so excited. And we get to continue talking about Tour de France and not just a wrap-up because the Tour de France Femmes is happening right now. So we get to continue the discussions next week.
Yeah.
I feel like Tour de France is this month that just keeps giving and giving and giving. And there's so much to learn with training theory. And
it's so fun.
Even how athletes approach training and racing. And I love it.
Yeah. I love cycling. It's like such a cool sport. I wish running sometimes had drafting like cycling does. Like obviously there's a little bit of drafting, but basically all of the strategy and fun of cycling comes because the draft effect is so huge. We were looking at a diagram recently that showed a Peloton, I think a Peloton moving at 25 miles an hour. On the very front, interestingly, the front person actually puts out less power than 100%. So there's a draft effect even when you're in the wind.
That boggled my mind.
It shows that I must not have been paying attention in physics class fully.
That was my exact thought too. Yeah. I was like, I truly don't understand the fundamentals of physics. Like so many times with chemistry or some of these, like a lot of these studies, even fish, I feel like I understand better, but I was like, damn, how does that happen?
I don't get it either. But then in middle back of the pack, so like let's say you're going 8 riders deep, you start to get to 6% of energy expenditure. So you start to see how teamwork and strategy makes such a difference. So we can't wait for that conversation.
I'm really excited. Well, it's a good thing because Jonas Vingegaard yesterday drank champagne as he was riding through Paris and he looked deeply uncomfortable drinking champagne, which I totally empathize with and understand because he was, you know, they do the celebratory champagne drink and he was just pouring it out on the road instead of drinking it, which I fully align with. But I feel like even after 3 sips of champagne, he needed all the drafting he could get.
He was definitely getting a little wobbly. Okay. So a couple high country tips. The very first one we wanted to mention is we finally got, for some reason we didn't have one of these, a Katahdin bottle filter. And I think this isn't just good in the high country. It's probably good for every runner that has almost any sort of clear water source on your runs. Mm-hmm. So basically there's just a filter in the top that gets rid of everything as you're squeezing it through and they run, that flows really well. Like this is going to be game changing for me. I can't believe I never had one. So I wanted to recommend out to you out there, get one of these. And I think it'll be really good for water sources during summer.
Also, this is totally unsponsored. We just randomly found them. It was like the first must be doing well on Amazon.
That's
the reason why we found them. But there's something so delicious about drinking high alpine water. Why does that water taste so good?
I think it's very cold.
That's true.
Good.
Yeah, that's true.
But I also think in a run, any water tastes good. It's like you could have that straight Philadelphia mucky water. You could be drinking straight out of the Schuylkill or whatever it is. Schuylkill. And you just be like, oh my God, this is delightful.
I feel like I earned it or something.
Yeah.
Which is like, I feel like sometimes as runners, when you say like, I earned the pizza, everyone like shits on you, but you can say I earned water.
Yeah, it's true. You didn't get dehydrated.
Okay, so, but question for you. So if you were to be able to choose between a filter, a SteriPen, which is like a UV light, and iodine, which is like the historic way that people use to filter water or to clean water, what would you choose? Those three options.
Well, I would definitely use the filter because it's so easy. You just treat it like a regular bottle.
I mean, well, they're all super easy.
Well, I mean, I basically, the SteriPen, that's basically like a UV light.
Yeah.
I don't trust that at all. It's much like the physics discussion. It's like, I paid attention enough to animals shitting in that water to know that we're not solving every problem with a little bit of a pen light. Okay. That's not going to do it.
But I got very into the science on this weekend. Yeah. I was like, well, what happened was I came home and I got really excited about this delicious high alpine water. And Leo was drinking from my water that I brought back. And I was like, I should probably understand the mechanism of this before we feed it to our small baby.
So you look this up?
I look this up. The SteriPens are actually much better.
Really?
Because the filters, they don't always filter out virus particles. Because those are so small, so they slip through the filter. Whereas the SteriPens kill everything, which is great.
Yeah, I just don't trust the pens. Like, there's no way it works. You can't convince me that light does that. You can't.
Okay, well, I think the gold standard is using the light and the filter. But also, interestingly, iodine doesn't kill like all protozoa either. So if you use iodine tabs, my take was on iodine was like, oh, it must be good. We're drinking like pool water.
Yeah.
Like that has to be good. But it doesn't even kill like crypto.
Interesting.
So cryptosporidium, which is a small protozoa. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were just saying cryptocurrency. It's like, damn, we do need to kill that. Yeah. The market's doing most of that work for us. But yeah, I mean, here's my real take,
what?
My anti-science take.
You're just going to drink it straight. Is that it?
It's all placebo. It's all just getting in your head.
I was reading some backpacker blog and it did this informal study with people that were on like the Appalachian Trail or something for long periods of time. And honestly, most of these performed at the same level of just drinking the water straight.
This confirms everything I've always suspected.
Don't drink the water straight.
That's all I've done my entire life and I'm totally fine.
I mean, why drink the water straight when you can shine a light into it?
Megan, I'm going to go in the skookal and just deep throat that stuff. It's going to be so good. Okay, number two that we wanted to just recommend a product. Again, not sponsored, but we talk a lot about ankle taping on here. And I think it's been kind of instrumental to my confidence on trails. And when I didn't have it last week at the race, I hurt my ankle again. It's gotten better with tape. And then this weekend, never twisted my ankle. And in fact, I was running with Drew Holman, fifth in the world, Drew Holman, this weekend. And he saw me get an ankle roll. But he also was like, wow, whatever you're doing for your ankles must be really good. Because how did that ankle not flip? So essentially, it just kind of kept it in line. So it was a slight turn, but not one of those really bad rolls where you're cussing up a storm in the woodlands.
The thing about ankle tape, though, so what ankle tape were you using? Because we've been onto this new amazing ankle tape that's been incredible.
So we just found this because it said it was featured on the television show Shark Tank, which is great.
You can
great
see marketing. We're highly susceptible. This is how we found all our products. Yeah.
Yeah. You can see why Google makes so much money, though. Because like the Google search is kind of directing everybody to these types of things. It's Hampton Adams tape. In fact, before this podcast comes out, I'm going to order a lot more because I imagine we're going to juice their numbers up. But it's essentially just regular athletic tape, very easy to tear, and it holds a little bit better in general. And we both have started using it in the last couple of weeks, and it's so much better than the tape you get at CVS or something. It's still not expensive. I think it's worth trying. We have ankle taping videos online. Check those out now.
I have so much confidence in this tape. Granted, we need another person to go on Shark Tank with tape because every time I wade through creeks, this tape and all other tape comes off. So we need a fully waterproof tape because I imagine like doing a race like Western States when you're going through so many creeks, it's like, how do you keep ankle tape on?
Well, I think you're just coming back to the duct tape idea.
I was going to say it all, everything aligns on duct tape.
Everything
all aligns. Shark Tank ideas align on duct tape. So I think true. That, yeah.
And the final little reflection is an interesting kind of recent study on social media use that we wanted to mention. And I've noticed this too. So just a thing that might help you. So this study came out in 2022 and it looked at how does social media impact performance? Like if you're using it and checking this out before you exercise, essentially.
And this was done. So 22 females were in the study and they did an 8-week intervention. So in the intervention, they had participants view social media 30 minutes before going to do their swimming training.
Yeah.
And then they had a control group view just Olympic videos 30 minutes before their training. And there was actually some pretty shocking performance differences when you looked across the study.
Yeah. And so essentially the control group, so the people that were just looking at videos, saw performance improvements across the board in endurance performance, their 100 meter time, the 400 meter freestyle. Meanwhile, the group that was looking at social media was stagnating or regressing. And these were all athletes that were, at the same level and they were elite athletes. And I think it points out how much that mental context can make a massive difference. And I notice it in myself too. Like if I'm scrolling Twitter before I run, even if it makes me happier in the moment, like which is an odd thing for social media, but even if I like it, it makes me less present with the activity and it makes me perform worse. And so I think weekends are great because we essentially sign off everything for a little bit and you just kind of are in the moment. So that's what I wanted to mention with this study.
It's really nice. Well, I actually couldn't access the full study, so it was unavailable. Stanford Library is probably on to me because I requested it. They're like, girl, we know you have a podcast. You're requesting a lot of these studies, but I requested it. But I wanted to know like what social media they were using. Also, I feel like not all social media sources are created equal. Like for me, scrolling Strava, totally different mental context than scrolling Instagram or Twitter or any other app, really.
Would Strava motivate you to scroll that before you run?
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
I feel so motivated by Strava. And I haven't always. I think that's kind of like a new thing in my runner existence, but I feel much more motivated by Strava.
I feel like a lot of people wouldn't necessarily feel that way because when you look at things, like even for me, when I look at a run on Strava and it says 10 miles and I haven't run yet, I'm like, okay, that's impossible. I could never do that. But you look at that and you're like, I can get out there and crush it.
Actually, every once in a while, I feel really motivated at like 5 a.m. Yeah. When it's 9 a.m. and someone has already run 15 miles and we're just getting out the door, I'm like, oh man, our day is getting started slow.
Yeah, I have that problem with my phone because I use Strava on my phone a lot because I'm carrying my phone anyway so I can be in touch with you on these runs. And often if I'm running a little bit later, my phone gives me a push notification that's like, hey, do you want to start an activity on Strava? I'm like, fuck you, phone. Yeah. Like, don't control my life like this. This could be, just be a rest day. Get out of my hair.
Yeah, I've disabled those push notifications, okay, which is nice. But actually, I would be interested in seeing this as a crossover study.
Interesting.
So in a crossover study, in a randomized control trial, you expose the group to the other intervention after a washout period. And I'd be really curious to see, like, I think the washout period for social media is very short.
Yeah.
So I'd be curious to see how that this holds up in a crossover study.
Yeah. And again, always just a reminder, pay attention to what lifts you up and what doesn't.
Yeah.
And something I've had to be extra aware of, and having a kid has been good for that, in the sense that I don't want to just make time pass ever. And like, I'm painfully aware of that now. Like, you know, and like, essentially you're nostalgic for the moment you're living in already. And so like, with social media, I've seen this in myself. And so for everyone out there, make sure you're paying attention to that, because otherwise I feel like time just passes and you just stagnate and you just kind of sit there scrolling.
I feel like we both have these very deep emotions with nostalgia.
Yeah.
We're like the fish sitting there at the bottom of the tank,
it's
just
so
like blub, blub, blubbing together and being like, nostalgia.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's like we've already hit the iceberg and we're spooning in the rapidly like overflowing room. No, seriously though, like that's how I feel in life. Like I feel like the water's coming up around me and I'm looking back at things that might not even have happened, but could have happened.
But it's so much better when it's experienced together.
So true. Yeah. I mean, and that's a good lesson for humanity together, or in general, is get your little person at the bottom of the tank, even if it's not a partner, like get friends, like open up like that, because I think it makes that shared experience a little bit more tolerable.
Actually, I was very curious about like what the biological sex relationships were between the animals that were together. And just, you know, are there like arranged marriages in there, or like, are there friends? Like what's the partner relationship like?
Get inside me.
That's exactly what it is.
Okay, so a few fun things before we get to some of the other science topics. The first is an interesting running topic. I don't really know what our take is on this, actually, so I'm be curious.
Yeah.
Is Shelby Houlihan, who tested positive for nandrolone. She blames it on a food truck burrito. I think the Court of Arbitration in Sport disagreed, so she's serving a four-year ban. She theoretically ran the 8-kilometer world record on Strava.
On the roads.
On the roads, yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Because the track has been faster. And it's incredibly impressive. It was 24:21. So 24 minutes, 21 seconds. And interestingly, when you click on it, it says this activity has been flagged, which removes it from all leaderboards. So I wonder, that must be a doping flag, I assume.
So when you flag activities on Strava, there's a number of reasons that you can list, like this is a bike, not a run, all kinds of things. I'm sure someone just flagged it and was like, burrito.
Burrito. But what's interesting is Strava didn't resolve the flag.
Yeah.
So Strava must be implicitly saying that we agree with flagging event or activities of people that are on doping suspensions, perhaps. Maybe I'm not putting that on them, but they clearly made a decision not to unflag it.
Which I actually agree. I think that's the appropriate way to handle this. I don't think she took any segments in the process, but it is, she did call it a world record on Strava. So I think Strava is doing absolutely the right thing.
Okay. She did have a lot of swag with the Strava description.
Oh, so much swag. Shelby has infinite swag.
She was like, the world record was blank. My time was blank. ..
Just saying.
And I don't know, like as much as like, doping is the worst, it also makes me feel like that's pretty cool. Like, I feel like any time that someone in life faces kind of the worst thing that could happen, even when it's self-inflicted, part of me gets really excited by the redemption story of like them finding joy again and purpose. And it's cool that she's found purpose even when, you know, she's going to get a ton of hate for this. She must have come to terms with that in a really difficult manner.
That was my exact take on it.
Okay.
No matter like, I don't think we're ever going to have a clear answer of what happened, but I think this is cool either way.
Yeah.
Also, I think it's really cool too. So you can go and follow her training, and her training is very, I mean, obviously to run a world record time, a world record 8K on the roads, her training has to be very structured and methodical, but you can learn a lot about training theory actually from her Strava. And we talked about her the other week on the podcast that she ran a beer mile record.
Yeah.
She trained hard for that beer mile. She was doing like beer mile. She was practicing with different types of beers. It was really fascinating. Yeah.
Well, I heard that after she ran the beer mile record, this is from inside information of someone that was there, that she had a burrito at the food truck.
Oh, mic drop.
Yeah, right.
Got to get that in Andrelone, right?
Yeah. And so it's mixed feelings, but also I do think it's somewhat inspirational. Not in the fact that she ran the record, like she's being banned. It's not an actual record.
Yeah.
And until she comes back, and when she comes back, she'll have a chance to, you know, reestablish herself. And I hope she does, just from the nature of redemption. But I do think it's cool for a person to find purpose, even when like they made a probably a life-altering mistake. So Shelby, we love you, even as we think that that Strava was a little bit spicy.
I agree. And if you're going to run a beer mile, there's a lot to learn from her Strava.
Yeah.
She was talking about like the different types of beers. I was like, I've never even had a Bud Light Platinum. I don't think I've ever had a Bud Light in my life.
A Bud Light Platinum?
Yeah. That's what she was trying with. And I apparently didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like Bud Light Platinum, you would probably want to go Bud Light Gold. But Bud Light Platinum doesn't really apply to running quite as much.
Too many bubbles. But can we talk about a clean inspirational story?
Yes.
So Emily McKay, I think that's how you say your name, on the track. So she recently graduated from Binghamton College.
Yeah.
And I remember watching NCAAs and being like, where is Binghamton College? Like, I've never seen anyone compete.
Okay, what state is Binghamton in? What do you think?
New York.
Okay, you know that.
Yeah.
Did you research it or did you just kind of like...
No, I mean, I haven't, but like...
You're exaggerating. Okay.
Have you heard of Binghamton College before?
I have.
But you also went to school in New York.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. I feel like there's... You always know someone that went to some random ass school, right?
Well, it's not random. I mean, it's probably a good school, but...
No, it's random. But that being said, basically every school is random. Like, I'll hear, like, I don't know, the small liberal arts schools in the Northeast, like I'm assuming Binghamton is, they sound like they're, like, create a player, like, kind of, like, made up by the AI systems, and that's what Binghamton is.
Okay, well, it's rare to see, I feel like, Binghamton on the track, and she was throwing down in the NCAA. Whenever you see an athlete come from a school like Binghamton, you're like, they're gonna be so good, because I imagine the resources, the training caliber, like, her training partners are not the same at someone as a school as someone, like, that's competing at Oregon or, you know, any other like NCAA dominant school. And she went on, she signed with New Balance and she just ran a sub 4 1500.
Wow.
And not only was it sub 4, it's 3:59.99, which is like the most epic way to run a sub 4.
Yeah. And there still aren't that many US runners that have run sub 4 over time. So this is rarefied air.
I'd guess just more than 10 probably.
Yeah. I think, I'm not sure the exact number, but I think so. I think you're around right there. And so that's super inspirational that like, you don't necessarily have to have all of your talent discovered early to find it later. So that's pretty cool that she's really uncovering her potential as she goes. It'll be really interesting to see where that ceiling actually could be.
And I think it speaks a lot for if you're recruiting athletes.
Yeah.
Like we think a lot in SWAP about recruiting athletes and like the talent that we're looking for that's underneath the surface. But for me, I love recruiting from like if I were someone like trying to build a pro track team, I would go to some of the like smaller NCAA schools that are a little bit more unheard of and find their top athletes because it's like those athletes have prevailed without probably like a ton of resources, training partners, maybe even coaching expertise. And I bet you she's so wildly talented. So I'm excited to follow. But the cool thing about this too is, so she ran at USA's, had a cold, finished eighth, and then came back and did this.
Yeah.
And I think USA's are fascinating on the track because it's like this big cornerstone of the season, but it's early season. And so many athletes who have like tough races there then have to go on and run big races. And it's so cool to see athletes like rallying beyond USA's.
Yeah. And this too is just indicative of how fast people are running on the track right now.
Oh, so fast.
I saw at a Diamond League meet, I think 3:32 for men for 1500, which is equivalent of a 3:49 mile, got you 17th place. It's like, what is happening in the world? Like, it gives me hope for everything. I think we're seeing this across sports right now. Like, you think about cycling is having this absolute breakthrough in performance. And if we're saying that's clean, which we hope it is, then you look at track, which is having breakthroughs too. It's not all the shoes. I think it's also these elements that we keep coming back to. Training theory of people not hammering themselves all the time while still doing good aerobic volume. And then fueling. Like, the more I think about this, the more I think fueling is kind of the big frontier where athletes are fueling their bodies so much better than they might have in the past. And in fact, Mark Cavendish was on a podcast with Grant Thomas on cycling, and that's what he attributed it to.
Oh,
so Mark Cavendish, later in his career, he's like, the place that has changed the most and the reason people are putting out massive watts now is because they fuel their activity like the science says, and that never used to happen at the start of his career.
And I think it's happening at the high school level too.
Yeah,
and I think I'd actually be curious to know like, if the magnitude of having this happen at the high school level is putting a greater emphasis like in these performances now compared to like having it happen later in life. But Nikki Hiltz too, they just set the American record in the mile
overseas, so
which was so wild. So I feel like we're just seeing these times drop and fall. It's so cool.
Faith Kipyegon, a 4:07 mile.
That was unfathomable.
When the previous record was like a 4:12.
Yeah.
It's such an exciting time to be a fan of the sport. And as you apply it to yourself, same things apply. Like even if we're not shooting for world records, I do think that every single individual can find this like reserve that is guided by both exercise physiology and psychology, the types of stuff we try to talk about in the podcast. So our goal, whenever we've mentioned this, is not to have you set a mile world record. It's to like try to explore where that potential is. And I think there's a lot there that is just starting to be explored.
And I think we're doing that like across the stage of humans too, not just in athletes, because we've been talking about Taylor Swift. I feel like her fatigue resistance is freaking off the charts.
Yeah.
And as we talk about like American records and world records and things like that, what she is doing on the performance stage is mind blowing.
At the Eras Tour.
Yeah. Well, is it? It's okay. So whenever I hear Eras, I say ERAS in my head because it's that was always the acronym I knew growing up for like electronic residency application system for med school.
Okay.
So I get so distracted. Anyone who's in med school is going to know that. They're going to be like, I get distracted too, Megan.
Do you think Taylor Swift knew that?
No, for sure not.
Okay, well, for me, what I think when I see ERA is earned run average, which is a baseball pitcher thing. So it probably shows our different types of like what we were doing when we were in college. We were like, I'm going to med school. And I was like, what are those baseball stats this morning? That's what I want to see. But yeah, Taylor Swift, I actually heard an interview this morning with Muna, which is a great band that I think opened for her a little bit on this tour. And what they said is, we do 30 minutes and we are totally exhausted and totally shelled. Meanwhile, Taylor Swift has been doing these 3.5-hour concerts, the 3.5-hour concerts, often two of them in a row, sometimes at altitude, where like 80,000 people are there to see her. And think about the athletic nature of that. It is remarkable, especially when she's at altitude. I can't even imagine how she's doing this.
It has to be so hard. And then she's going to bed at 1:30 in the morning and waking up the next day and doing it again. And she is stacking ultras and back-to-back ultras. I bet you she fuels her body well.
She must.
I mean, yeah, but she has to. Yeah.
There's no way to do that. Or she has some food truck burritos that supply her catering.
Or she's just a starfish. Yeah. And she's like, whoop, and snatching the sandwiches.
But isn't she, I mean, like, what made me think about is that, you know, obviously doping in sports is illegal and unethical. Is doping in like, let's say you're a performer or an actor or a dancer, is it unethical and frowned upon in those areas? Do you have any opinions on that?
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, you're a role model. And I think sometimes if you're getting to be a role model through ways that are like are subverting human physiology, that's frustrating to me. But I mean, there's no rules against it. Yeah. What are your thoughts?
I think it is unethical, but maybe it's just because I'm viewing it through a myopic lens of athletics.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, think about Taylor Swift doing 2x3.5-hour shows at altitude. It's like, well, if she took EPO, that'd be a lot easier. And then she'd be
giving I'm pretty sure that has no performance gains with singing.
Well, of course it would, though, with altitude, like, responses in general.
I mean, she's doing, like, one how many shows do you think she's doing at altitude?
But anywhere.
Yes.
Like, having more oxygen on board will improve performance. And we know that's a thing in Hollywood, let's say.
Yeah.
Is, like, steroids are rampant, right?
Oh, for sure.
And
yeah.
For both men and women and everyone. So, like, it just raised some interesting questions. And it also raised just questions of role models generally.
Well, I guess for me, it's like, how are steroids different than plastic surgery?
Yeah.
I mean, aren't they essentially like you're subverting your natural physiology to attain some end goal? Just one is through medication and one is through going under the knife.
I need to think about that a little bit more.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
No. I mean, I like that. That's a very interesting ethical like conundrum there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it just is interesting to think about like how these types of things could influence the way we think about how people perform everything. And this is us bringing, you know, people have done doping speculation about Jonas Vingegaard winning the Tour de France or like Barry Bonds hitting home runs. I think this might be the first time it's been Taylor Swift for beast ass concerts.
Okay, she's clean as fuck. Okay, she should be honored that we're having this conversation because she is so good.
We're the biggest Taylor Swift fans.
Yeah, I wouldn't say we're the biggest Taylor Swift fans. There are some big ass Taylor Swift fans out there. I could probably list like 12 of her songs, which is embarrassing.
Yeah.
There are people that could list like all of them. Actually, if I could list 12, that would be good.
Yeah. I don't know if
I could probably list five.
But you would know a lot because we do listen to Taylor Swift.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. I do really, really like her.
She's great.
I heard the Miss Americana, you know, documentary on Netflix with her. Definitely recommend. She's an incredible person.
She's incredible. Also, I love what she's done for like female empowerment and basically like self-empowerment for anyone out there. Like she's been an incredible role model, especially politically too. So I think she's amazing. I don't think we're her like biggest fans. It's hard to be her biggest fans. We're too busy thinking about starfish.
Okay. As I slowly back away and hide my shrine that I've slowly constructed to Taylor Swift out of toothpicks and old hair.
Well, then we still wouldn't be her biggest fan.
It's true.
Because someone is doing that with like...
with her hair.
Yeah, exactly.
Literally Taylor Swift's hair.
Exactly. That's my point.
I was using my hair and Addie's hair, which is totally different. Okay, final recommendation. This is actually quite serious. is we stopped at Taco Bell after our race. Taco Bell might be the best travel meal, and no one told us it. Like, I feel like Taco Bell is always made fun of. Taco Bell rocks. It is awesome. It is great. It's good for gluten-free people like Megan. Totally recommend Taco Bell.
Oh, it was so good. I didn't even get, they have like the Dorito taco shells, yeah. Which I freaking love Doritos. I didn't even get those. I got the normal corn tortillas. But I do think you should preface this with, as we were eating it, you're like, this is the best food ever. It reminds me of being in a cafeteria in fifth grade. And so that's what you consider to be the best food ever.
We were talking about nostalgia. That was me consuming nostalgia.
That's true. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which, I feel like we could just sit in our tank and consume that and be so happy.
Yeah, and also good for vegetarians. So basically what we're saying is when you're traveling, you know, you're just kind of looking for anything. I think often people stop at Subway. Let's change that. Let's have your stops at Taco Bell because it felt great. It was delicious. I totally recommend it. And we were debating what the meat was. I settled on cat. but it was delicious, so I went with it.
I didn't order meat.
Yeah.
I couldn't order meat at Taco Bell. I don't know. I was weird. I had a bean burrito.
I'm sure.
Or bean tacos.
I'm sure it's fine. I mean, you know, basically, like, whatever it was fine.
Yeah.
It was,
like, I've been having a harder and harder time consuming types of meat.
Yeah, Megan, like,
I think too much about it. I'm still eating meat, but
those horses were done. Anyway. Like, what else are the horses? No, I'm just kidding. Like, it was totally good and totally recommend it. And so, this is just a bunch of random fun things we've talked about, but on Patreon, we've just started recommitting on there to doing weekly newsletters in addition to Science Corner posts, in addition to bonus podcasts every single week that are 30 minutes. We're going to be writing a ton there. So patreon.com/swap, SWAP. You're going to get lots of interesting things, especially at that huzzah tier.
It's so much fun. I love when you start writing and I can see like the wheels churning in your brain and then you get really excited and you read to me sentences. And it's one of your cuter moments. You're like, you're so proud of yourself. You're like, look at the sentence I beautifully crafted.
Well, that's what I mean, that's all I ever wanted to do with writing. And I've just kind of gotten disillusioned with the like media circle in general out there.
Why?
I don't know, Megan. It's just like I'm creating a piece of content that just gets consumed and shat out by the algorithm in like a second. And, you know, I've written hundreds of articles at this point, some of which I think are quite good and quite important.
Oh, so many good articles. Yeah.
It just in my own head, you know, just to validate what I'm doing. But then like it just feels like I'm throwing, you know, grist into the mill. Whereas on Patreon, it doesn't feel like that because I'm getting to communicate with friends that are engaging directly with it or not, but it was like, it's people that are opting into it rather than people that are just scrolling by it on Twitter. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm curious where, because I feel like a lot of people feel that way. And that's been like, I feel like a lot of writers have said that they feel disillusioned by the current way that we think about content. Yeah. And I'm curious to see where I feel like we're ripe for changing that and for having something new percolating in the next 5 to 10 years. And I think Patreon's a great format for that now, but I'm also curious where that goes 5 to 10 years down the road.
So true. So patreon.com/swap, SWP. So now we have a great listener question. You moved this up. I actually had this at the bottom of the podcast outline. It means you're ready for it.
I'm so excited. Yeah. We're going to talk about AI.
And
I love AI.
AI is so cool. So here's the question. Then we'll do like a just riffing on it. So I've been thinking about something called AIEndurance.com and other AI coaching systems out there, so artificial intelligence. Any thoughts, any evidence out there on their use? And I fucking love where AI is going. It's scary, but it is so interesting. And so we want to talk about this because if you're not with it right now, get with it. It is going to change the world, and I think it can already make your life way easier if you find out different ways that you can incorporate it. Whether that's coaching, we'll talk about that now.
So many different random ways to use AI too. I mean, I've seen actually people have incredible success using AI for like meal plans or like, what should I get for dinner or like things along those lines. I personally love using AI for images. Mm-hmm. So one of my favorite things when I do presentations is like so-and-so trail running and just to populate a picture of someone trail running and being like, yeah, it's Steph Curry running on a trail. Yeah. He looks damn good.
Well, I mean, what I love using for it is I have a ChatGPT window always permanently open on the left side of my screen. And so that's what I recommend. That way you're encouraged to use it often. It's to summarize long pieces of text. So you can summarize a article, let's say like a scientific article, in a way that just nails it down beautifully. Or if you get, let's say, a 3-page email.
Have you been doing that for podcast research, by the way? I actually haven't. As I'm sitting here, because it's like, I don't know. There's a part of me that feels like it's cheating. Like for the podcast, I'm like, I need to read every single word of this article.
And I think that's why people are hesitant on AI, because it does feel weird. It feels like it's like you're cheating on a test in high school or something.
Mm-hmm. It actually performs there's been stuff like AI has passed Wharton business school tests. Yeah. And like really complicated tests.
And it's just the start. Like this is going to be wild. And if you use it and start to experiment with it, you see how much things like your prompts matter. And I think sometimes people use it once and think that, oh, this simplistic thing is not going to be useful for me. Once you start to delve into it and give it more information and like tell it what you actually need and want, it can get wild. And what I saw recently is ChatGPT added that you can tell it background of what you want from it generally in terms of your type of personality. So Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, which is the company that created ChatGPT, said, I'm the CEO. I want direct, quick answers on everything that I'm asking you. And so it's game changing, I think.
How would you describe yourself? Like if you had to put in two sentences about yourself and what you wanted out of ChatGPT or AI, what would you say?
My self-esteem isn't great. I need you to make me feel really good about myself as you're talking to me about what I should get for my meals. It's like, your lasagna is going to be quite good. It's going to be so fantastic, David. You're definitely going to know how to do this and you're not going to make the noodles soggy.
Your Taco Bell is going to blow your mind.
Yeah, exactly. So some uses we've seen, summarizing scientific articles, as I said, headline writing. So if you're writing something and you want a title for it, just plug it all in and it'll give you 10 options that are great. Or research, as long as you fact check the research, because it will make up things like citations. But in terms of general approach, it knows everything that's ever been on the internet. So its base of knowledge is bigger than any human brain could ever have. Use it because it's not just like easy, it's also instant and can spur your own creativity. So that's what I think of it most as, is right now it's a creativity spurring tool and a knowledge generating tool. Later on, it's probably going to be something much more, maybe something a little bit more sinister, a little bit more scary.
I love it for writer's block. Like I feel like for me, sometimes I have the hardest time writing that first sentence. And I think if you put in a body of information or like write a first sentence to summarize this, and then you can use that as a building block.
Yeah.
For me, it just gets my brain going and then I can write the rest.
Yeah.
But that's so helpful. But also coding too. I use it. I mean, it's game changing for coding. If I had this in the beginning of my PhD, it would have been so much better.
And you can just ask it follow-ups on everything.
Exactly.
And this is going to be ubiquitous in the world. And so the reason that I'm trying to use it is not because right now it makes my life way easier, but because I know that if I gain skills right now, I won't be that person that starts using the internet in 2000 and is like, oh, what is this thing? This is like 1994 in the internet, 1993. Like, we're not the first ones, but if you're an early adopter, you're going to be more prepared for how this is going to change the world and like what might happen. So I also think it just raises a lot of interesting ethical, philosophical questions.
Mm-hmm.
Like Sam Altman, again, I love him as a person, but he's also clearly like a little bit of a shit stirrer. And one of the things he was saying recently is that what is creativity other than building on what has already been in existence and then iterating on it based on a prompt? And so essentially what he's saying is that art is just the spit outs of these machines and that these machines are moving towards some sort of consciousness, sentience, even if that's not what we describe it as. So like, how much of our brain is just a large language model that's determining the next word in a sequence or the next thought in a sequence? It's kind of scary to think about what we think of as consciousness might just be properties of physics and a lot of information.
It's pretty wild thinking about our brains is just like, basically all currency as language.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, our brains is building on all of that currency all of the time.
Yeah. It's so weird. So as it relates to this specific question, I think we're very expansive when we come to our interpretation of AI, it seems. So do you think it's going to be useful in coaching?
I think in coaching a little bit. I think it could be helpful and kind of like, I think actually I'd be really curious. I haven't actually personally used any of the like coaching models. I'd be curious to see.
I haven't looked at AI endurance stuff.
How it performs. I mean, you could feed like Shelby Houlihan Strava in there and be like, you know, create a model similar to this. I don't know. It weirds me out still a little bit with coaching that I haven't played around with it with coaching.
No, I haven't played around with it at all, but I think we'd be stupid to think it's not going to be every single field like that.
Yeah.
Right. So it doesn't have the data to be a good enough coach yet.
No.
Like, there's no way that AIendurance.com, it works. Even though I haven't looked at it yet, it just doesn't have the data.
And it doesn't have the personal communication too either, because I feel like so much of how we iterate on athletes' training plans is coming from this information stored inside our head, which is very much like AI.
But why can't it do that eventually?
Yeah, but eventually it probably could.
Yeah. Yeah. So in other words—
No, and I'm aware of that. Yeah.
That's why we have a podcast. Granted, what if AI takes over our podcast? It's a weird world out there. It's going to be strange. But the point being,
we got to send AI to the aquarium and be like, go to the restaurant after and make sure you have the fish tacos.
That's why. So, okay. serious note, though, the serious note on a very unserious topic. You know, I made that incredibly cringe-inducing, like, sex reference earlier or whatever.
It wasn't cringe-inducing.
But the thing is, that popped into my brain.
Yeah.
And that is the one spark of human creativity that I think you need to hold on to really tightly in whatever you do. Because anything that you do through, like, cognitive wheels turning, hamster on the wheel, will be able to be done by these systems when they have enough information. Mm-hmm. So, like, even something basic, or not basic, complicated, hopefully world-class. I mean, I think we're two of the better coaches out there. If we plugged every single training log we've ever done into one of these systems, if they had access to that data, which through Google, theoretically they might, they'd be able to do a close enough facsimile to what we do to make what we do seem like less groundbreaking. Even though there's a human element there, though, that is that moment of inspiration.
Yeah, in the process, they wouldn't be like, here's a random bivalve joke.
Or whatever that similarity is with mm-hmm. a number, right? So like the AI might say or think this is what you should do, but the instinct is a human instinct, not a scientific one, that knows that the athlete actually should do something else in this particular instance with all of this weird information mixed in, including not running information, including information about totally unrelated things, like that you read To Kill a Mockingbird in high school and it gave you some sort of understanding of nonlinear approaches to consciousness that a computer can't get because it thinks in a more linear fashion. So basically, that's my long way of saying is like, make that sex joke, do that like blink instinct thing, keep embracing that part of yourself, because if you don't, you're going to be replaceable by AI.
And actually read To Kill a Mockingbird. Because yeah. I imagine, like, how much do you think this changes AP Lit classes in high school where you can just be like, summarize Kill a Mockingbird for me. And sure, we had Spark Notes in high school. You could be like, what happened in this chapter? But I feel like actually do the dirty work of reading these things because it adds, I don't know, I feel like it adds so much too.
Maybe, maybe not. It depends what you want from life.
That's true.
Like for law school.
I want To Kill a Mockingbird vibes.
This would be game changing for law school. Oh my God. Yeah. Every single case you get, like, you just be like, hey, tell me about this case. Like, I mean, the education is changing for sure, but everything is changing. I just think we're in the middle of a tidal wave, and some people think it's like a boogie boarding, like, little two-footer. And it's like, no, this is a thousand-footer. Like, get out of the way and also figure out, like, move inland. Like, move inland. And so I'm excited about it, but it's only because I think – The alternative is having your head buried in the sand.
Well, I can't believe you're using a water analogy when we established the fact that we feel very uncomfortable out at sea.
Exactly. Yes. I think a lot of my discomfort actually comes from tsunamis, from tidal waves.
Well, you had this irrational fear of tsunamis as a kid. How have we never talked about this on the podcast? Not actually, we might have.
It was a phobia. Like, every single time being at the beach, just looking out to sea, being like, when is the big one coming in?
I totally get this phobia because we were in the high country this weekend. Yeah. And there was this random waterfall up at like 10,000 feet. And I panicked in the middle of the waterfall because I felt like I was out at sea and I had to go on all fours to cross the rest of the waterfall.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring this up. It'll make everyone feel very good about their own fears and stuff.
This was literally, so there's, when you're out adventuring, there's all these different classes, like class one, class two, up to class five.
I think it ends at five. Yeah. When you're doing on that scale.
This waterfall was literally a class one.
Yeah.
If we were climbing, it would be a 1.3. Yeah. And I had to be on all fours to cross it.
I crossed it. I just kind of ran across it on the rocks. And I mean, yeah, I took a couple good steps. I'm pretty proud of myself. But then I turn around and Megan is stopped on the middle rock, just like, what do I do? And there were like, the best part is there were like 5-year-old kids behind you.
And I was holding them up.
Yeah, you're holding. And then you just go on all fours into the waterfall, just getting your head doused. So you can just say you were practicing cooling.
I felt out at sea in the middle of the mountains and I felt deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah. Okay. So I think that was actually a really interesting conversation on AI.
Yeah, that was fascinating. I'm curious. I mean, I really do think AI is going to be this tidal wave that takes, I think when Leo is 8, we're going to be asking him questions like, what did you learn about AI in school? How can we like get on this train?
Or maybe we're overstating it, but I do think for things like coaching, if it had the right data, it'll be good. So to answer this listener's question, I think running will be more difficult. I think sports like cycling and Nordic ski and stuff like that will be much easier.
Because they're power-based?
Because there's much easier to get the metrics that you need to plug in the data.
Yep.
Whereas in running, it's a lot more complicated, I think.
I think
especially cycling, I think, might be, that's going to be game-changed much sooner.
I think running is often more indirect metrics than cycling, which you have, when you have power, it's a much more direct reading of an athlete's, where an athlete is, what their training is, how they're structuring workouts.
And just embrace the human element. Embrace the weirdness of you, because that is the one thing that probably can't be duplicated, because that weirdness only comes from nonlinear associations and we're hundreds of years away from that, I think.
This is a good episode for that thesis because yeah. I feel like we've been exceedingly weird in this discussion.
This is like a shoulder episode because we had like Western States and Hard Rock and all these other ones. And on this one, we're just kind of emptying the tank with things that we're just fascinated by.
It's really fun. Yeah. Yeah. And we're like getting stuck. It's like me being in the waterfall and being like panicking halfway through. Be like, we're on a class one and this is hard.
Yeah, exactly. Which brings us to the next study, which we are both fascinated by. This is on stress mechanisms. We've mentioned it briefly on a past episode, but we're going to break it down a little bit. It was from the journal Psychoneuroendocrinology, and it's called Cellular Allostatic Load is Linked to Increased Energy Expenditure and Accelerated Biological Aging.
I love the duende of that journal. They're like, yeah. We're just going to throw together three things in a thruple and see what happens. Three scientific things. But I think this is really fascinating. And yeah. We haven't talked on here a lot about the concept of allostatic load. Yeah. And for me, like, it's a term that I think sometimes when people hear it, they're like, what the fuck does that actually mean?
Including me.
I feel like it's like thrown around all the time. But the principle of allostatic load is just that we're talking about the cumulative burden of chronic stress.
Yeah.
And allostasis is the process in which the body responds to stressors to be able to maintain homeostasis in the body. And so you think about that allostasis coming together in allostatic load.
I actually was using ChatGPT earlier, much like you would use Google, to be like, what does allo mean in the context of this word?
It means different, right?
So the cool part is when you put it into ChatGPT, what it does is it summarizes in the context of the scientific history, not just the like suffix or prefix, Latin of it. And so it just shows like little uses of this.
What did it tell you? I think the Latin is like different.
Oh man, I didn't internalize what it told me. I was like, I don't give a shit. I'm never going to use this again. What I care about though is the general principles of this type of study. And so this gets back to the cellular level context type information that we always talk about, in that often in training, we're thinking about numbers and how your body is responding, but how your body is actually responding happens on the cellular level, and how that like homeostasis is maintained is insanely important to think about as an athlete, because you're constantly perturbing homeostasis in the nature of these stressful things we do to our body. So even though this study is not at all around athletics, I think it's a good analogy to think of when you're thinking about how you should plan your own life. So we're going to have takeaways at the end after the kind of some of the, you know, nitty gritty talk about what they did here.
And I would estimate that I think that like 95% of what we talk about on the human physiology standpoint comes from the body context.
Yeah.
Whereas when we talk more about like what's actually happening on the cellular level, there's much less discussion about that. And I think it needs to happen more.
Definitely.
Would you agree with that breakdown? That's just like a very rough guesstimate.
I mean, I think in training theory, almost all of it's being talked about.
I mean, it's so also hard to do on the level of the cell.
Yeah, it's almost all on systems levels, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why cellular level thinking is so important. And I think it also liberates athletes in how they think about their own training. So
no, I read this and I was like, rest days.
Yeah.
That was like the main thing that came to my mind is like, let's reduce allostatic load because holy shit, this has huge impacts on the cell.
Definitely. And so the way this study was designed is it took three lines of human fibroblasts cells, and it treated them with chronic glucocorticoid stimulation. And that's essentially a way to induce stress. They were unrelated lines of cells. So there were more generalizable results. We're not just looking at a genetically heritable thing. And they were evaluated across the 150 to 250 day lifespan of cells.
And stress sometimes is a good thing. Like our bodies are constantly under states of stress. And the goal is not to like reduce stress entirely. But if you think about what happens in terms of runaway stress, how much that jacks up the allostatic load. And this study was looking to measure the long-term perturbations that happen as a result from that.
Yeah.
And I think this is a great, so this is the rationale as to why they did the study. And I think it's better actually, I'm just going to read the quote better because they explain this better than I even could. They said, stress triggers anticipatory physiological responses that promote survival, a phenomenon termed allostasis. However, the chronic activation of energy-dependent allostatic responses results in allostatic load, a dysregulated state that predicts functional decline, accelerates aging, and increases mortality in humans. So essentially, yes, we want to adapt to stress, but runaway stress has all these downstream consequences.
Yeah, and the authors said that this aligns with chronic stress pathophysiology in humans. So even though we're just looking at cell lines, this isn't a human under, you know, doing something that stresses them out. Theoretically, it should be a little bit more generalizable across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like to differentiate the stress framework in is chronic stress on one end, so you're constantly under load, and acute stress on the other. So the body is made for acute stress. That is why we exist as humans. It is the only way that we survive. It is what evolution has framed itself around. Chronic stress, meanwhile, there is an element of it that your body can respond. But to do so, to maintain homeostasis in the state of chronic stress, it throws everything off because it's like survival. And so acute stress, okay. Chronic stress, okay as long as you understand what you're doing to your body and get off that train eventually. And that links to the results of what they found.
And what they found was one of the first things was hypermetabolism. Yeah. So essentially these cells were just having extreme amounts of increased relative energy expenditure, yeah. which is fascinating. It actually made me think about like cancer cachexia. And so like cancer patients that are really sick at the end of life yeah. often have really elevated like metabolic rates, oh. hypermetabolism, which is something that's kind of not intuitive. You would think that the body just like yeah. shuts down and drains off. But no, these like hypermetabolic states long-term are really unhealthy for the
Interesting.
Body.
Interesting. That's wild. Mm-hmm. I had no idea about that. And so that hypermetabolism, and this is kind of similar to what like we might do to our bodies if we're constantly burning a fuck ton of, you know, just like needing a fuck ton of energy, is linked to mitochondrial DNA instability, which is bad. And then number two, it non-linearly affects age-related cytokines secretion. So that's not good. You've probably heard of cytokines in the context of disease processes, much like COVID or something like that. And number three, it accelerates cellular aging based on DNA methylation clocks, telomere shortening rate, and reduced lifespan of cells.
And telomeres are like the hot topic right now. I yeah. feel like if you put telomeres in Amazon, it'll pop you up like a whole bunch of like random things, but you really don't want to reduce.
Was that your way of saying that I was pronouncing it wrong when you pronounced it?
I actually don't know who's right.
Okay.
I say things really funny.
Okay.
Yeah. I would never quote beyond pronunciation.
Oh, I was really.
I do think it's telomeres, but I have no idea.
Okay. I think
but you, said, you know, I've heard that word so many times. But yeah. It's funny. Even at that point, I still say things funny in my head.
What I thought of would be a really funny Strava title. So occasionally there's like ads on TV for these things that either measure telomeres or say like telomeres are in your aging and here's how to make them whatever. Either it's medication or something like that. I thought a funny Strava title would be currently 78 in telo years. So it's interesting to think about that you do want to avoid these chronic stress states. And this looks at why that happens on the cellular level. But let's zoom out a little bit, mm-hmm. think about training and what we might be doing. Because it gets back to training is a very healthy thing. We get actually emails into the podcast all the time asking us to talk about what is training for long-term health, longevity, things like that. The general rule is it's okay. It's great. But there might be a U-shaped curve where it's really good at some levels because those stress responses are actually very productive for the body, lead to good metabolic cardiovascular outcomes. But if you do a fuck ton of it forever, maybe it's not great all the time.
Well, I'm pretty confident in that fact. Yeah, that there is some inflection point. And I think it probably differs for each athlete yeah. too, like where that inflection point lies of being like, yeah, this is unchecked chronic stress yeah. in the body that the body's going to have a hard time adapting to.
And I think those lines are actually really far. So I think sometimes athletes that are doing like even 80 miles a week will be like, is this too much stress on my body? It's like, no, probably not. You're probably fine as long as you're not going too hard. Where it starts to become an issue is when athletes are under load for the sake of being under load. Mm-hmm. And the chronic stress is held up as the proxy for adaptation or hard work or whatever. And you see this often in like, you know, Strava volume profiles. Like, does your weekly mileage matter? Absolutely not. The one place it might matter, it only matters as a proxy for the stress that you need. The place it might matter though is if you're overdoing it constantly and not taking rest days and not backing off, you might just be actually measuring in that high bar chart how much are your cells getting fucked? And that's where it becomes really important for training theory. And it kind of zooms out to what we want to talk about and, you know, the constant messaging of our podcast.
Yeah, it's rest days. I read this and I was like, in conclusion, rest days. Yeah. Of course, this was not related to exercise physiology
at all. And it might not even relate exactly to the findings, but I think the generalizable approach.
And a lot of what they're talking about, though, too, is also very much under discussion. I love their discussion section. They were just like stepping up to bat and just taking huge fucking swings.
This
and I loved it.
It was
such a well-written study.
I loved it. It was one of my favorite basic science study publications ever.
I agree.
And so you should read this.
I think it has also proxies to so many different fields. I mean, we're sitting here talking about it in the framework of exercise physiology, but I feel like it could be talked about in any other field.
Residency.
It's why it's in a journal that's stacked together a throuple of fields.
Yeah, exactly. And so rest days, you know, we recommend one rest day a week, even though 6 days of volume is less than 7 days, your body does not know other than reducing the stress. So I always tell athletes, if you're doing, you know, 60 miles on 6 days, that is equivalent to 70 miles to the body. You don't need to do 70 miles to adapt to that type of load.
And you know what's wild? Shelby Houlihan ran that 8K road record off of 70 miles a week of training.
Interesting.
Yeah. Granted, we always talk about outliers and it's a little unfair, but to me, I feel like 70 miles a week of training for an athlete at her caliber actually isn't super high quantities of training.
You know, it would be a great grist for the mill story
what?
When I think about writing all these articles. breaking down Shelby Houlihan's training intro on her magazine or something. Wouldn't that be wild? It would get
the comments. It would get flagged. It would get the equivalent of Strava flagged, Megan, on TrailRunner.
I would get so many fucking clicks, and all those advertisers care about is those clicks, honey.
Yeah, but you would get so many negative reviews.
But who gives a shit?
I don't care either. Yeah,
it's grist for the mill, baby. I'm like using all these like little words. It's like honey, baby. It's because I'm like, this is totally ridiculous. Other one, importance of Z1 in your training, low level training, easy running, easy exercise, easy cross training. Doesn't really load your body that much, especially as you adapt to it. You can do this at high levels without much of a concern. So reduce the intensity on some of those days and you'll adapt and at a cellular level be more healthy.
Well, I know I'm like 60 in telo years because we ran 3.5 hours on Saturday. And when we finished the run, I was like, I'm so excited for a Z1 day on Sunday and a rest day on Monday. And sometimes it's nice going into big training sessions being like, I have Z1, I have rest, like, it is time for this to be a nice stimulus and I'm going to chill and recover after.
Definitely. And then thinking about cortisol, so the stress hormone, even though that's not what they were measuring directly, that is a proxy for probably some of the things that they're measuring. So if you're under a lot of cortisol load, like, be careful in that context of training. So new parents, let's say, or someone with a busy job at work, or someone dealing with mental health struggles, like all of that stuff needs to be incorporated into how you think about chronic stress and chronic stress load over time.
I love that. And that's often not captured in the Strava bars.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I feel like so much sometimes like running the data is like made out to be really concrete, but there's like so many other data points that go into there.
Yeah. And then the final one is just fueling and hydrating. So fueling your body is one of the ways to really avoid these super stressed states. And I think the hard part is like, there's all this talk out there about like time restricted eating and intermittent fasting and whatever else is being done in Silicon Valley by these people. And it's like, okay, for a non-athlete, maybe that harnesses some of these weird cellular level processes in ways that don't hurt them. But if you do anything other than just fueling your body a ton as an athlete, you're going to be under so much excess stress that will fuck you over. So that's why, you know, this is so important for adaptation.
Your allostatic load is going to go bananas. Yeah. If you're trying to like stack on time-restricted feeding and training, and it's like the body can only handle so much stress. And I think that's really important. But it's actually this whole conversation too made me think of ashwagandha. So ashwagandha, we've seen like kind of like baffling magical stuff related to ashwagandha, which is a sentence I am scared to say, but I am saying.
Well, no, I mean, you know, the hard part is it's tough to isolate. So let's bring some science into it. There was a review study on ashwagandha, which is an herbal supplement that's totally legal. And here is a quote from that study. Based on a model of predictive regulation, ashwagandha might help overcome the allostatic overload and accelerate exercise-induced adaptations by the activation of actuator variables that modify the allostatic state. Albeit further standardized research is needed to have a better comprehension of its effects under certain biopsycho-environmental situations. That was a good thruple, biopsycho-environmental.
I know, this whole podcast is just a thruple of words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So interesting there. And, you know, again, different things work for everyone. This is not necessarily studied that much. This was a big review study of like 45, but some of those are probably done by industry sources. Mm-hmm. Who knows where the funding's coming from? A lot of these studies actually aren't from like, you know, a lot of them are done in India, the country, because that's where the, whatever that type of medicine that ashwagandha is a part of is used. But as we're thinking about different ways to manage your stress, also think about your biomarkers, the types of things you can do to help your body. Ashwagandha might be one of them. And guess what? Ashwagandha is in athletic greens.
Not surprised at all. Actually, before we were recording this podcast today, I was like, must have athletic greens.
Yeah.
It puts me in a good brain state.
It puts me in a good brain state too.
And except when I have to drink the, so for me, I actually like the taste of athletic greens, which is, you don't love the taste, but I hit the bottom. And as soon as I hit the bottom, it's like, there's something in my brain that turns off and it's like, I must go starfish mode in order to get down this last part.
That's why you need to put like a scoop and a half in case you just want to skip the very end.
Oh, that's a good idea.
It is a good idea.
Yeah, so, it's a little wasteful though.
Again, no, because you're actually going to drink it and then you're just going to get extra.
True.
I do two servings a day. I just do
two servings a day.
I do two scoops.
Wow.
Because I want my ashwagandha.
Yeah.
So the cool thing about athletic greens, the only place that ashwagandha is safe for sport. So it's certified that it's totally clean, which is insanely important. So drinkag1.com/swap, SWAP. But even if you don't use that source, look into some of the research on this supplement, because even though we're not saying you should be taking it because we don't know, we do think that some of the way it interacts with stress is kind of interesting.
I've seen really good anecdotal evidence on it too.
And so,
And what is your stance?
Well, we're recommending people to take athletic greens. We're not doing that just because they, you know, help buy some Fritos, right? Like, we're doing that because we genuinely believe in it. And there's a reason I'm taking 2 servings. And the reason I think it works is probably some of these micronutrients or the herbal supplements or things. And I love that it's safe for sport. So that's awesome. I mean, basically I'm putting my money where my mouth is.
Yeah. So Athletic Greens to reduce allostatic load.
Yes. Let's do it. Okay. Let's do a Tour de France wrap up. What do you think?
I'm so excited. Oh, but I'm really sad it's over.
Yeah. Well, we got Tour de France femmes.
Oh, I'm so excited.
So Jonas Vingegaard is a total beast. After last week's episode where we were teasing the time trial where him and Tade were going to go head to head and Tade was going to win because we love him, Jonas kicked his ass, rode one of the best rides of all time, ended up winning by almost 8 minutes. It was insane.
He royally kicked his ass.
It was bad.
You know, I feel a little like seen when I watched Jonas because yesterday in Paris, so we talked about the champagne situation, which he had to throw out the champagne.
Yeah.
But I don't think he can ride with his hands off the handlebars.
Well, when he's drunk a little bit, for sure.
They were trying to do the picture of the team and he was like wobbling all over the place. And I was like, Jonas, that's your class one waterfall. Yeah. He was stuck and panicked.
One of the most wild things I saw in the time trial was they have this year the team radio on the screen. So sometimes they'll display what the team director, so essentially their coach or their manager or whatever, is saying to the rider. Mm-hmm. And what they said to Jonas back before they had any time splits, when I was still hopeful that Tade would win the tour, is essentially show them who is the strongest. So the manager was saying that to him. And I was like, okay, they would not be saying that to them right now unless they really knew that Jonas was going to open up a big old can of whoop ass.
And instead of them, I think show the world who is the strongest. So it was like, I don't know, that felt like war talk or something.
Yeah. And another interesting thing from the manager is they said around that performance, he had 4 blood tests given for doping in 48 hours.
Wow.
And so that gives me a little bit of hope too. Like, you know, it's much harder to be doing something when you're getting that much blood taken from your body every day.
Well, I've also heard his VO2 max is off the charts. Yeah. Insane. I mean, I think he's just a specimen of a human.
Yeah, I heard he got measured at 97 when he was in high school or like when he was like a fish packer a while back. So, which is the second highest that's ever been recorded. And the first highest was a guy that had never displayed his talent because he just burned out. It was like the burden of genius. And so maybe Jonas is just the best athlete ever that's actually explored this talent.
Okay, but Pogacar,
yeah,
he's like my favorite athlete ever.
He is.
He's so great. Well, he won stage 20.
Yeah.
It was great. It was heartwarming. So after he had a rough time trial, rough stage the next day. Then he came back and he won stage 20 and he was so happy and celebratory as he crossed that finish line. And as a result, I was too, but I was really proud of him because I think coming into the tour, he obviously wanted to win the whole thing. Jonas is a very hard competitor to be up against, but seeing how happy he was after stage 20, it was like, you know, he's probably all in all had a disappointing tour in some ways for him, but there's still so many little things in sport to celebrate. And I got excited about that.
I also love that he's like, I wanted to DNS after he got his ass kicked in the mountains after the time trial. So he's just gotten his butt handed to him 2 times in a row.
It was so sad. It was hard to watch.
His body was wrecked. Some people were speculating they had cold sores. So he's just like overstressed and everything, which is probably everybody in the tour.
His allostatic load was off the charts.
As every rider in the tour is like the definition of allostatic load.
We should just give him some Athletic Greens on the side. Yeah, yeah. So every once in a while, there's someone that's like standing on the side of the Tour de France with like a pizza, enticing bonked out riders to grab a slice. And we should just have AG1 out there.
He's doing a lot more than Athletic Greens. I'll tell you that much. But he said that the other riders on other teams were coming up to him at the start of an easy stage, a flat stage that they had, and just saying like, you know, we're inspired by you, which is not something that happens in the peloton often. And it's cool that he even... one of the best riders ever. Like, I still think he's the best rider in the world, even if he's not the best Grand Tour rider in the
world. He's also so young. He's 24.
Yeah. And whereas Jonas wins Grand Tours or the Tour de France, the biggest race, Tade wins every race, like every classic, every other race. And so I was inspired by that. Also inspired by Mohoric, who won, I believe, stage 19. And it was a surprise win, even though he's won a stage in the past, he's just been struggling. One of his teammates actually died in a bike race a month before the tour. I think it was the Tour de Suisse or something like that. And so everyone was riding with a heavy heart, not just that team. And this is what he said after the stage. It means a lot because it's just hard and cruel to be a professional cyclist. You suffer a lot in preparation. You sacrifice your life, your family. You do everything you can to get ready. And then after a couple of days, you realize that everyone is just so incredibly strong that it's just hard to follow the wheels sometimes.
That was such a beautiful quote. And do you know what it reminded me of? Is almost exactly what Katie Asmuth said after Western States.
Interesting.
This year, you know, she put in so much to get to Western States this year. She had navicular surgery. She rallied back from sickness, from other types of injuries. And yeah. she showed up on that starting line, but it took so much out of her.
Yeah.
And she was reflecting post-race and something like very, very similar about sometimes how cruel it is to be a professional athlete.
Yeah.
And I think so often, like sometimes we look at professional athletes and like, they have all day to train. They have all day to recover. But it's like, no, that job is so freaking hard.
And I think it's athletics in general, not just professionals.
Yeah. You know, everyone goes through the same thing. Yeah.
It's so hard.
But I think when it's what defines like your contract, your existence, your financial state, it is, there's an added level of how challenging that is.
Yeah, but I've seen the mind fuck happen with everybody, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Especially the mind fuck, the part of it, it's just hard to follow wheels sometimes. Like you're like, these people are so strong. And this is someone that won the stage in the tour. Now imagine what someone feels that's finishing at the back of the pack.
Yeah.
Like very last finisher. It's probably, these people are just so strong. Like I'm trying as hard as I can. I can barely hold wheels, if anything, you know? And I think that that shared feeling of inadequacy is part of athletics too. Because like, we all have it once we like, you know, even the best in the world. Like I'm sure Tade feels it in reference to Jonas Vingegaard. And so that's one of those moments to like grab all your fish friends and hold them real tight. Because I think everyone in athletics is kind of pushing back against that feeling of not being enough and not being able to hold wheels. And that's where Mahorich's win and quote comes in, you know, so much sharp relief for me is that like this guy ends up winning a stage and that's the moment to sit down and celebrate. Take mm-hmm. the moments to celebrate fully. Because those are fleeting in between interstitials of, you know, inevitable inadequacy.
But those are who you are, too. Yeah. I mean, this reminds me, we've talked so much about Andre Agassi because we're obsessed with his book. But he talks about the idea all the time that he'll go 15 races yeah. or 15, I'm calling him races,
yeah.
15 matches and have 15 wins. And then he has one and it ignites this huge struggle of momentum inside him. Yeah. And it's like just how hard that is. But you truly have to celebrate those moments. And know that the moments that you're performing and winning, like that's who you are. Like you're not yeah. the one random loss that happens statistically, like as a fluke at the moment.
I think you're your best moment always.
Exactly.
Your yeah. fitness, your brain, mm-hmm. all of that. It is your best moment. Don't average out shit because as soon as you do that, you're going to be taking and just cutting yourself down.
Yeah, I love that.
And I loved as you were talking, your arms were going so wild over. You must have been inspired by the octopus we saw at the aquarium and you hit the mic. So our listeners might get a little bit of like a bass on your mic drop.
I just wanted to do a backhand like yeah. Andre Agassi.
And instead of a mic drop, it's just a mic wobble.
Yeah, a mic backhand. Yeah, yeah.
And now we have the Tour de France Femmes. So next week we'll be breaking down some of the storylines of the Tour de France Femmes. We're so excited. It's women's cycling is taking off. It's one of the more watched sporting events in the world now, like in just the first year last year. So very excited to see what it does this year.
I'm so excited for this. It's amazing. Well, they used to actually have the stage overlap in Paris with the men's yeah. finishing stage. And this year they have their own like stage start. And I think it's really cool actually that they're setting the women apart from the men
yeah.
as opposed to lumping them together in the final stage.
Yeah, I can't wait. Okay, so do you want to talk about loving running or the study on menstrual cycle?
Actually, let's talk about loving running.
Okay.
Because we've had a lot of science on this episode, but also too, because I do feel like this feeds off some of the conversations that you're just having with Andre yeah. Agassi and Mate Mohorič in cycling, because like, you know, yeah. when you get deep in the trenches of training, whether you're doing this recreational or at the top level, it's yeah. freaking hard.
It's hard to love
running. It's hard to love cycling. It's hard to love tennis.
It's hard to love anything.
Actually, Andre Agassi hated tennis.
Yeah.
The number of times in that book he says the word hate, it's, I mean, probably more than hundreds.
Yeah.
Especially in reference to tennis.
Yeah. And so, okay, this general conversation was motivated by an athlete we coach who's going through it a little bit with running.
Which happens.
Like, yeah. you know, they're in a busy, stressful time, starting their career, all this other things. And they were just essentially questioning their running commitment in general. And they're like, why do I struggle with this? And those types of things. And I had a response that you can roast if you want. But here it is. I think that love is an intentional act made over constant little decisions and recommitments. And falling out of love is just inevitable entropy without those things. I believe in you. And as a result, will continue to give you urging to make those little decisions and recommitments. But I validate whatever decision you make in the end.
I absolutely love it.
Oh, you do?
I do. I concur with that. But do what's fascinating?
What?
So you just wrote this at some point. You just like dropped this into the podcast outline this yeah. week. And I assumed because of the like content of what you wrote that you were talking about relationships.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually agree wholeheartedly in response to relationships too, because I feel like love in the relationship sense is also an intentional act. It's like being in a cage with your fellow fish at the bottom. And it takes so much intention to keep that going.
Does true love exist?
Yeah.
But does it?
No, I think it's intentional.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, does true love of running exist in the same way?
So I my take.
So I think, I mean, it's all in the eyes of the beholder.
Well, my take is that true love, implies that something is an absolute truth. Like, you know, like the absolute value of a number almost, but applied to emotions.
But can't like 1,000 intentions add up to that?
I don't think so. Because yeah. I think it, even after true love, what comes next? And the answer is some sort of recommitment, or yeah. it's not going to be true love anymore.
Okay, I agree with you.
Sure. So yeah. I guess my point is like...
I mean, I think I'm looking at the word of true as yeah. like...
As opposed to false love?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I guess my point
but
is
But it's more a granular truth.
I like that. And, but the, I guess essentially the place that I have trouble with people talking about love in that way, including loving running. So the reason that we're talking about this is in the context of athletics, but whether that's relationships, literally anything you do in life, is that the baseline state of it is nothing, or is just, you know, stagnation, is entropy, is mundanity, is mundaneness. It's all of these things, right? That is what happens without energy being injected into the system constantly. Yeah.
But I also think that energy, like if I were to look at the love of our relationship when we yeah. first started, we are 8,000 times beyond that. I think because of the energy that we've injected in daily, monthly, yearly.
But I don't think it's true love, right? Like
no, and it's that, not, but that's my point, yeah. is that if it were, it would be stagnant across that yeah. time.
But I think people expect love to be easy then, because they think that, oh, like, you know, they look at us and they're like, oh, they found each other, they're meant to be, all that stuff. It's like, anyone who says that.
Oh, we've had to work really fucking hard.
And yeah. And
it's been great.
But every relationship.
Yeah.
In fact, I was listening to Shania Twain. I love that we're hour 10 into the podcast. This works. What was her song? It was essentially a love song. You're still the one I
know. That you was know. Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, everyone knows that song.
Okay. You singing that, that's true love.
Okay. Yeah. but the point being, I believe that her and the person she was singing to ended up getting divorced
in
a very
yep.
acrimonious mm-hmm. fashion.
Yeah.
And you don't see the song after that. It's like, you're not the one for me, or whatever. You know, like that song doesn't get written. And as a result, people see these snapshots and think that whatever it is natural. And this also happens on Instagram with running.
I was going to say it's the exact parallel of social media, Strava, anything related to running.
Or even people, and they expect that to be in their own heads. When in reality, like, I think that anything we call love is essentially someone that has decided to absolutely commit truly to something every day.
Well, I think true love is not actually true love. I think it's just commitment and trust
yeah.
magnified over days, months, years.
And a leap of faith as a result.
Yes, exactly. Because,
like,
yeah.
It, you know, when you're trusting someone else, let's say in a loving relationship, or trusting something else in the context of running, you have to be aware.
Or yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, true. You have to be aware that you're going to get fucked, possibly, in a bad way. Uh-huh. Like in the sense that I don't know what's in your brain. You could leave me at any moment, right? So love is a leap of faith. In running, you could get a pelvic stress fracture tomorrow.
Oh, I'm very aware of that. Yes, you know, postpartum.
Yeah. Or whatever. And for this athlete that's asking this question, it's like, you know, running is going to tear you up. And you don't need to choose running in the same way you don't need to choose a relationship. But like at a certain point, you have to make the leap to make the decision for love to ever happen.
And I think that leap, it's not like this. I mean, sometimes I do think it's a fuck it moment where it happens all at once, yeah. but I think it's micro leaps that happen every single day, because it's like that recommitment also is not, there's like challenges and forces against that recommitment every day.
Yeah. And so that athlete wrote back a really articulate and beautiful response. And I responded, yes, I absolutely love that commitment. This is something we have now been talking about for a couple years, just zooming out with the athlete. And as you see in your job too, so this athlete works with people, it's really hard to think yourself out of a box like this. You just move forward out of the box. Doing the thing day after day eventually just becomes what you do. And eventually that becomes who you are. You are amazing.
Also, I love you just have, you are doing great exclamation point at the end.
Yeah.
It's very sweet.
Well, I mean, because they are doing great.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
And I think sometimes.
Well, I think anyone that wakes up and like pushes back against us is doing fucking great.
Yeah. And as a coach, you get you're privy to people's questions, especially as it relates to running, but also everything. And then in my own brain, I'm privy to my own questions. And like you think about all this stuff and so much of life, of society, of things is find what you love to do. Find the person you love to marry. And all of it is essentially saying, here, make these impossible daily decisions over and over again without being certain. Mm-hmm. And so what I always encourage people to do is make those leaps of faith, commit as hard as you can, and put your trust in someone and something, and understand that you don't have to be committed forever. You're going to get burned. And that's the process of life.
Dude, I love that so much.
Do you truly love it?
I love it with recommitment and trust.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the magnitude of time.
Yeah. And so with running, like just try to recommit every day. And that means rest days. It means accepting that it sucks. It means understanding all of that. But for me, it becomes insanely important because I am not naturally motivated as an athlete, but I am able to make a decision every single day because like my brain chemistry allows me to do that.
Well, how do you do that? Is there like, sometimes you procrastinate, we both procrastinate yeah. sometimes to get out the door. How do you actually turn the wheel to make that happen?
I try to think about it. I mean, I know that's a deep question and, yeah. and we've been talking in deep ways, but like the more I think about that question, the less likely I am to like pursue the actual truth of the situation, which mm-hmm. is making the decision to do it.
Yeah.
So you can't think yourself out of the box. I try not to think.
I like that.
Do you think that's reasonable?
That's very reasonable.
How do you do it?
Caffeine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, brain chemistry, that matters a ton. And that's where this type of conversation becomes really difficult. Like you think about a relationship. It's well, if one person is dealing with depression or they change over time, then that decision totally changes. We're totally different people than we were 13 years ago when we met.
Oh, totally different. Yeah.
And we've
scarily different.
And so we had to make decisions that the new version of the other person with the new version of myself is worth that and is that love. So I'm excited for, another hopefully 70-ish years of getting to make that decision with you.
Wow, you have a good approximation of our Tilo years. Well, I was going to say 60. You're dreaming big over there.
Well, yeah, for you, or I think it depends. Like one of us will outlive the other, which will definitely be you.
I don't think so.
Will you love me after you're gone?
Oh my God.
Or maybe we'll go out like those people on the Titanic.
Yeah, just be one with the fish.
Be one with the fish. Granted. How I swim, if we ever go in the water at the same time, that might happen in advance.
I would much rather be one with the trees.
Me too. Okay. Was that a good conversation? Interesting, I think.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really care. I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it too.
Yeah. That's my primary summary. This is what happens over an hour and 15 minutes. And this is for us.
That's also an amazing way to frame it too. It's like, I don't really care. I enjoyed it. That's how to think about your running.
Yeah.
I don't really care. I enjoyed it. And enjoy it also just means like, accepting that it brings every emotion under the sun with it.
Yeah,
it's and I think that's what love yeah. is. Just like love of a person is not just good emotions. It's also like every single one of my biggest fights in my life has been with you.
Yeah.
Every single one.
Yeah.
But that's love. In the same way that every single one of my happiest athletic moments has been in running. Also, every single moment where I've been absolutely spraying poop on the side of the trail, hating life, like has been through running.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's love is...
Or eating at Taco Bell. Just kidding. That's never happened to us at Taco Bell.
High five. Perfect way to end that one. We're going to do... Okay, very quickly, actually, one question from a listener, because I think this is relevant in the loving yourself perspective. Another question. Okay, so the question is, how do I stop being so sweaty? I live in New York City, and I'm aware it's July, but is it normal to be the sweatiest person in every group run/workout class? I feel like my heat tolerance is pretty good, but my body just turns on the faucet and it gets so uncomfortable. Any tips or wisdom is appreciated. Thank you so much.
Okay, love your sweat glands.
Yes.
That's my primary hypothesis on this.
So we talked about this on Patreon. I wanted to bring it out in the Patreon podcast. Shows the types of questions we answer. We answer like 10 of these a day, but also the really deep ones on training. What we talked about then is embrace your glands. Like you have no control over your sweat rate. That is something that is genetic. Make sure you don't dislike something about yourself or try to hide something about yourself that is endemic to who you are, that is a part of who you are, especially in your physiology, whatever that is, whether it's sweat, whether it's your ears, whether it's your stomach, anything. Love that shit because otherwise you are left in a place where you're going to be constantly uncertain about how to make the step to actually loving yourself.
Because otherwise it'll just be an AI system.
Yeah.
AI systems don't sweat.
No, that's true.
Yeah. They don't actually have physical sweat. So
no.
Maybe at some point in time they will.
Yeah,
they'll have the fruits of labor. But actually I had an athlete that didn't like their sweating. And so they went on a medication to stop sweating and their performance precipitously declined.
Yeah.
Also they really struggled in heat environments. So love those glands because they're also doing good things too in terms of heat dissipation.
So love your freaking glands.
Yeah.
So I think having these conversations after the AI is really appropriate, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because we said AI can do a lot of what we do.
It can't sweat. Doesn't it have glands?
I don't know if it can have the weird conversations that we've had. And also, I think somewhat interesting ones. Like it could do pop philosophy like we've done at times in these conversations.
I mean, if we fed it this podcast, it could probably have slightly similar conversations.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I think we're evolving too fast for that, though.
Yeah.
You know, I think that...
Us or humans?
Us. Humans aren't evolving very fast.
Yes.
But like our brains are. You know, in the way that we're moving through things and problems and rethinking on the fly is something that computers can't do.
Yeah.
So
it's great.
I think it's appropriate. Okay, let's get on to some hot takes, which I'm actually next week, I'm going to ask AI to give me some running hot takes. And we're going to do AI hot takes next week. Okay, so we're just going to do a few. We can just choose out randomly. I'll do the first one. You scan and see which one you want next. Slightly spicy one. Sorry, David. David would have won the Canyons 100K if he'd worn a race vest rather than a fanny pack, as he wouldn't have lost his big-ass gels that he needed.
I fucking love this listener, because I told you the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I was like, so David, you need to be prepared for logistics.
Yeah.
The amount of logistics for this race require a race vest.
Because there wasn't really good crew spots. As a reminder, I lost my fueling that I really needed and like had a tough period in the race. I don't think it's true that I would have won, but I do think it's true that perhaps I should think a little bit more about going back to a vest for Grindstone 100K.
I totally agree.
Do you?
I am so, I mean, I didn't generate this. This is shocking. This is actually listener generated, but thank you because I agree. And I will go out on the limb and do a spicy hot take. And I actually do think you would have won. You can't say that yourself.
I wouldn't have though.
But you're so talented right now. And
but no, even before the fueling became an issue, I had already dropped down to second place. So like, it wasn't like I was going to close faster than the other people in the race.
No,
so
you were.
I think fifth was perfect for the day. And it's what I needed at the moment, but good take, listener. You're challenging me in ways that I need. As always, these hot takes are submitted on Patreon, so very interesting. Do you have one that you want to read next? Have you scanned down the list?
Yes. Okay. Classical music is some of the best music to listen to while running. I once started crying during a tempo run while listening to
Rachmaninoff's?
Yeah, Second Symphony.
Rachmaninoff. It shows that I am not a classical music expert.
It sounds like his name is just a throuple with words. It's much like the journal article, just nonsensical words.
Yeah, so his Second Symphony, if anyone else wants to listen to it, I disagree maximally. Classical music? What?
Okay, I really like Riverdance.
Yeah.
Riverdance has like a driving beat. I don't think it's considered classical.
Riverdance is the pop punk of classical.
That's true. There's a blue electric violin in Riverdance. Yeah. And as a kid, I went to see it and I was like, I want to be that girl so bad.
Yeah. Well, classical, I mean, it's interesting what this person's saying. I like it for you. And for others out there, maybe try it if you're on the fence about music because you can enrich your brain with the historic composers.
I mean, do you think it's actually enriching compared to Ludacris?
I don't actually.
I don't either.
I've always thought that's bullshit. And I mean, we're raising a kid right now on these principles that everyone tells us like, play classical music for the baby, read them really appropriate books.
Meanwhile, I just held up Ludacris to my belly when I was pregnant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a baby raised on Ludacris. He seems pretty happy so far.
He does seem pretty happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been trying to raise him to the Lonely Island. So, Lonely Island, for those that don't know, you must go back and listen to their history. It is such good music. It's all humorous, but it's also just very good. Andy Samberg, can't remember the other guys, but they were, you know, got famous through Saturday Night Live. They were nominated for Grammy, Emmy. So they're, you know, really well respected. But the thing that made me get back into them is I heard rappers talking, saying that their favorite rap group was The Lonely Island. It is the best for running. I've had some of my best running ever to this band. So listen to them on Spotify. You will not be disappointed.
Sometimes I'll hear you downstairs on the treadmill just laughing like a little baby down there to yourself. And I'm like, oh, it must be a Lonely Island. Like that. You'll do that while you're running. Yeah. I'm like, what is wrong with him?
Just listen to Lonely Island makes you so happy. All right. On to Listener Corner. Hi, David and Megan. I've been listening to your podcast for nearly a year and a Patreon member since April. I love your show and have incorporated several of your teachings into my running. Your advice resulted in a marathon personal best and Boston qualifying time.
Oh, heck yeah.
So amazing. That said, I often find myself wondering, how is it that a black man from suburban Philadelphia probably doesn't drink the Schuylkill River water, I'm assuming.
He's still here.
Yeah, he's still here. Exactly. You wouldn't be able to listen otherwise. Would come to love Swap. We have nothing in common, so I thought. Today, while running and listening to this week's Tuesday podcast, I heard the words Conestoga High School, Megan's alma mater. I graduated from Stoga in the 1980s. I've had the great pleasure of living and working around the world. Early in my journey, I learned that if you're patient and listen closely to other people's stories, what you share in common will be revealed. Megan, from one Conestoga alumni to another, huzzah!
Huzzah! The pioneers! That was our mascot.
Yeah.
Which was actually kind of a lame mascot.
Yeah, it's not very cool.
Yeah.
But this listener is incredibly cool. That is so, so fun.
Isn't this amazing? Yeah, thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, it's fun to think about someone from your high school listening. So, hey, if anyone from my high school listens, message.
I doubt it.
We didn't have too many people that seemed into the SWAT podcast based on how popular I was in high school. But yeah, that's really cool.
This is really cool.
I love it.
I'm a big fan. Anyone that's gone to Stoga, we might actually, I know there's a few other alumni out there that listen.
Okay. So you have more, that makes more sense to me. I grew up in a very rural place. Like there's been this whole discourse recently about country music, talking about small towns. And a lot of those country music songs are actually written by people that grew up in like Macon, Georgia, which has 200,000 people. Like I grew up in an actual small town in that type of area. And I don't know if my vibes were necessarily appreciated. Maybe they were, though, and maybe we'll find out from the podcast.
Fun fact, I think we shared this before in like the very early podcast days. You could buy the cigarette in your town.
Yeah,
which
at
is
the time.
It's probably still the same.
That's the very first thing I did to Megan when I was wooing her, when I was courting her at the start of our relationship, is I took her to the little corner store that was a few miles away and showed her this, because I think it's illegal. And I was like, this gives you an understanding of why I'm not particularly like good with what fork to use or whatever, or even like any sort of table manner. It's because I was more thinking about this type of world, and it was a great way to grow up. I loved it.
You also bought me an orange soda on that trip too. And I was like, immediately true love.
Yes. And guess what, guys? We love you all. Make sure that you give us 5 stars, subscribe, click follow wherever you listen to podcasts. All of that stuff helps us out a lot. Basically do all that if you can right now, in addition to perhaps signing up for Patreon if you want. You don't have to do the Patreon thing, but do give it 5 stars.
Parting question for you.
Yeah.
Is orange soda true love?
Yeah, I mean, orange soda does break the rules, right? Because it's not a decision. Just every cell in my body is like, yes, must consume this, must be inside of me.
I feel the same way.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. I think our love can align on that true love.
So everyone out there, do whatever else we said, but mainly get a Fanta today and celebrate your badass selves.
Ideally at Taco Bell.
We love you all.
Woohoo!
Huzzah!
Boom. Orange soda time.
Get inside me.
Just kidding. That's so weird. Okay.